those issues except for
Okay.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to go ahead and open an informational hearing for the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today is February the 26th, 2015, and we are gathered to hear today for an informational hearing, Minority Women Emerging Small Businesses and Contracting with the Oregon Department of Transportation. I would like to welcome as guests of the committee the soon-to-be two esteemed co-chairs, Representative Buckley getting water, and Senator Devlin, who will be with us shortly, our colleague in the Senate, Senator Shields, and our colleague in the House, Representative Fredericks. So welcome to our little committee.
Thank you.
Before you have an agenda, and I will invite Director Garrett to come up and introduce the first topic. And are you bringing Mr. Lauer with you in round one?
Let me do a quick opening, and I have Mr. Lauer and Mr. Gesher come up here.
Thank you very much. All right, welcome, Mr. Garrett.
Excellent. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. Appreciate the opportunity here. You know, as we begin this conversation, this is a complex and nuanced issue. There's little question about it. But at its core, what we're going to talk to today is really about workforce, how we educate and reach back into the high schools, into the community colleges, how we move that into training, how we move to certification, and then eventually how we contract with the individuals who help build the transportation infrastructure here in the state of Oregon. Our goal is simple. At ODOT here, the charge is to grow workforce opportunities in the heavy highway construction discipline for prime contractors, for subcontractors, for minority-owned firms, women-owned firms, and small businesses as a whole. And when I speak of small business, when I use that term, I use it in the most broad sense to identify all the various elements that truly are the backbone of this state's economy here. Little question, that we must ensure we have a skilled and diverse workforce to address not only the infrastructure needs of today, the immediate needs we have, and they are many, but as well as the future needs. And that's really when you look to the horizon. How do we ensure that we have a queue of development, of individuals that we can groom, that will eventually make their way to journey status, that will eventually make their way onto contracts as primes, as subs, growing opportunities. So again, it's a continuum that we look at. And that really is the approach we take at the Department of Transportation. We approach this as a continuum strategy. So in your handouts, we provided a PowerPoint conversation. I will not speak from this, but I will speak to it, to be very honest with you, because this is a resource document. It does speak to that continuum discipline that we use at the department here. Three issues we'll speak about today, or certainly is the hope we speak about today. One is the pre-apprentice. This is the reach back. Then I'll ask Mr. Lauer and Mr. Gesher to come up and give their insights on apprenticeships. And then we'll move into disadvantaged business enterprises and a disparity study that we are engaged in that helps us identify opportunities to create a level playing ground, to allow the opportunities, equal opportunities for folks to compete for contracts here in the state of Oregon. So pre-apprenticeship, journey status, and then on to the contracts here. Let me quickly walk through pre-apprentice before we get to the apprentice discipline here. This Ways and Means Subcommittee is quite familiar with this conversation because we had it last session, and we actually grew the investment in pre-apprentice opportunities here. You'll recall 0.5% was a term we used. It's federal dollars. We grew that amount to up to $2.1 million to make investments in a partnership that we have with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, BOLI. We animate activities that, again, as I said before, outreach, reaching back into the high schools, exposing folks. Because in the heavy highway world, I think you'll hear from some of these folks, if you don't have a family member associated with heavy highway construction or the heavy highway trades, you might not know the career opportunities, the breadth and depth of career opportunities that exist. So we're trying to expose, and we believe going back into schools, and we've actually gone back beyond high school into grade schools here to try to teach folks. Community colleges becomes another resource. It is about career exposure here. Basic skills. This is fundamental. in the pre-apprentice activities we do, we truly teach individuals how to be a good employee. What are the characteristics and attributes that are needed to ensure that you secure a job, but then you grow in a job? And sometimes it's very simple that you have to show up. And you have to show up each and every day. And you have to travel to where the jobs are. Fundamental issues we engage in, that basic skill. Various assessments of where people's skill sets are. Trainings. A lot of training is done with the small business development centers across this state because our reach has to be across the state. Career counseling, mentorship. Some of these gentlemen and these people in the contracting world here can teach you how they take people on. And because they have prepared the way, they have walked the pathways, the mentoringship is a great opportunity to leverage the collective wisdom we have here. On-the-job training. On-the-job training, boots on the ground, but certainly with the intent to lead workers into the apprenticeship system here. So again, supportive services, simple things that become barriers that prevent people from engaging. The ability to have the finances to support childcare keeps women and single parents out of this career opportunity. Fuel assistance, just the ability to travel, don't have the money to do it. Tools and equipment, making sure they are outfitted, that they promote and project and carry with them the appropriate tools to get the job done. And then finally, just paying for overnight expenses while there is a job that is away from home. These are part of the investments that we put toward pre-apprentice here. We have seen some of the fruits of this labor, this $2.1 million that came out of this subcommittee. The last go-around, let me give you just two quick examples here before we move to apprenticeship. In the highway trades, female apprenticeship and apprentices of color account for 16.5% of all new apprentices. This was in 2005. As we turn our attention to the 2013-2014 timeframe, that share has risen to 26.9. So we're making a difference. We're moving the dial. Specific to women in the construction field here. Nationally, women make up fewer than 3% of the construction workers across the nation here. In the state of Oregon, we can be very proud to say that women make up over 6.5%, nearly doubling what we do. And we were just recognized by several studies most recently here. So I would submit to you that these two examples, and there are more, are evidence of the important progress that we are making in growing and diversifying the state of Oregon's heavy highway construction workforce. So, Madam Chair, with that as preamble and really setting the stage before we get to the apprenticeship, what I'd like to do now is ask Tom Lauer, the ODOT Technical Service Manager and our Chief Engineer, along with Larry Gesher, who is the President of HP Civil, based out of the Staten area, to come and share their perspectives on the apprenticeship discipline. And if you're comfortable with that, I'd like to invite him up now.
I'm very comfortable with that. And colleagues, we welcome Co-Chair Devlin. And I want to announce that on the telephone is Scott Williams, who is the president of Hamilton Construction Company in Springfield. Mr. Williams, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate the opportunity to call in on that, but thank you for that.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair, a quick question, if I may, for the director.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Director. You cited some impressive statistics a few moments ago, but I'm wondering if a women-owned or minority-owned company is not certified as such, would they be included in those numbers?
They would be, because we look at Madam Chair, Co-Chair Gomberg. They would be included in there. But let me tell you something. This is a good question, and again, this is going to beg for another conversation when we talk about certification. And we're just learning this through our disparity study, and we'll speak a little bit about that a little bit later. Across the nation, and we believe it's replicated here in the state of Oregon, only 1 in 5 firms are certified as disadvantaged business enterprises. Now the question is why? Why only 20% of the folks who could play do play? And are there not benefits? So we're asking those questions, and the disparity study will inform that. But we look at those that are certified and those that are potential or could be certified. So we use that whole universe here. So we're capturing that.
Thank you. Thank
now
you,
that's the DBE versus apprenticeship here, but it's an interesting conversation.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Mr. Lauer and Mr. Gesher, or whatever order you want to go in.
Go ahead. For the record, my name is Thomas Lauer. I'm the chief engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I'd like to maybe set the groundwork in terms of where did our apprenticeship program come from. And it started with the 2003 legislation for the OTIA Bridge program. And in that, it required that we establish an apprenticeship program for both economic development and to develop a broader and more skilled workforce. And it was also recognizing that we had information from the Department of Boley that our construction workforce was aging and there was a crisis in terms of long-term replacement of workers for our projects. From that, as Matt has indicated, the program we developed at that point, starting in approximately 2004, was a federally approved diversity program to develop apprentices. We worked with the workforce, it was called the Workforce Development Plan, and it was partnered with Boley, Oregon Community Colleges, support contractors, and on-the-job training that we had. It was, again, federally approved. A lot of outreach was done in coordination with, going to high schools at night and with the workforce providers. We also work with the Oregon Jobs Corps Training Center, and we had a good outreach program. Now, simultaneously, near the beginning of the program, we started putting apprenticeship requirements on our contracts. And I like to think that it was the phase or the first program we put forward. And I will tell you truthfully, it was a complete failure. The program did not work. It was overly complicated, very hard to enforce. It was complex, had a very detailed reporting that was slow and lagged and wasn't useful for anybody in the field trying to monitor what his contractor was doing. They weren't sure what how well they had performed or where they were lagging. It was very specific per craft. And none of the union craft trades were very pleased with it. They were upset with it because it wasn't performing and getting apprentices out. And there was a lot of, was it evenly balanced among the crafts? And as I said, it failed. We really could not show that we were doing reasonable performance. And so in about 2007, it took us to launch it, get some contracts underway, and then actually start to see the performance that we found, okay, this isn't working. We were not in a happy place with our contracting partners, the AGC. They were equally concerned with it. There were lots of difficult conversations that were going on between us at that point. And then finally, in 2007, we had kind of a showdown meeting. We said, this isn't working anymore. We have to do something differently. And we recrafted the program we have today, which I have to tell you is a stellar success. And in part, it comes about in that it doesn't have all the details. It does not have the overt requirements or rules that we had in our previous program. It starts out very simple. We actually put a hard requirement in each contractor's bid when they bid for one of our projects. And the contractor is actually forced to have that included as a cost within his contract. And so we turned it into an incentive-disincentive program, where we require them to produce so many hours within the contract if they want to get paid for it. And if they don't, we actually apply a disincentive into their final payment, subtracting their poor performance. We put no craft restrictions. We put no restrictions on whether it was the prime or the sub. Bring in the apprentices, make them available to the job. We'll score them as they go. We'll pay you as you go as a part of the contract payment. And I'll note that even while we say we're paying for them, in this state with unbalanced bids, a smart contractor will realize that labor we're paying for really exists in other bid items. And to get to a low bid, they will subtract that labor cost often from the other parts of their contract. So in net, we're paying literally a very low cost. There's an administrative fee and of that sort. And we said, if we really want you to perform, we also want you to go beyond any target we're putting forward. So while we may, and I'll just use a simple number, say require 1,000 hours in a contract, we told them we'll pay up to 150% performance. So if you can go as far as 1,500 hours of apprenticeship, we'll keep moving that far so that we'll incentivize them to go beyond whatever target we set forward. And I have to tell you that it's wildly successful. If you hear about any other apprenticeship programs around the state, look to see their size, their breadth, and I will compare it to other states as well, and look for hard results out of those programs in terms of actual hours that they can document and certify that were actually performed on the jobs, and that they have hard numbers to show the effects they have. And at that, I'd ask you to turn to page 14 of your of the handout we have. You know, this chart speaks volumes. There are variances in the program year to year. We generally achieve over 10%. The hours swing wildly, and that's primarily because the type of work we're doing changes. If we're doing a lot of paving versus, say, bridge work, paving is very material intensive and has lesser labor. So if our program is balanced that year for more paving work, you'll see that the hours may be down. In other years, we may have more bridge work and it goes up wildly. And in some years, we are extremely successful. And I'll show you to 2013 on the chart on the left-hand chart on page 14. You can see we have a large number of hours achieved that year, 67,000. But our relative percentage is low. So our percentage is not always the only way to look at the success of this program. It's actually hours achieved. And as I say, I know of no other program in this region of the country that is nearly successful as what we've been able to do with this. Flipping to page 15, you can see that we're doing consistently well in bringing in women into the workforce. And these are numbers that are not documented ever before in our history, and so we're doing reasonably well there. And if you go on to page 16, you can see we have a breadth of diversity in the program as well. It moves and the numbers change year to year, but that's primarily partly in part, where is the center of our work? Is it in eastern Oregon, near a tribal area? Is it in southern Oregon, in the Portland area? As the workflow moves, we do see a change in the different groups that are participating and the rate at which they're participating.
Madam Coach, go ahead.
Mr. Lauer, does this track how long a person works for you or just that they did?
Just that they did, Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Tom, I'd heard some concern in the community that particularly women were not getting to the journey level and participating in hours on some of these projects. Could you address that?
Co-chairs, Senator, that is becoming a concern for us, to saying not just women, but all apprentices, are they moving through? And while I will say in the early part of our program was getting people into it, identifying and bringing folks in, and making sure that they were truly getting apprenticeship hours within the programs, we're now starting to focus on our efforts to saying, do those people finish? And no, I don't have hard numbers. We can, if we have some, I can make sure they're provided to the committee. But we're now starting to shift our focus over to, are they moving through and graduating, and are there impediments to them doing it? It's the natural evolution or maturity as the program moves forward. I think in years forward, we will see a point where we're continuing our outreach to bring new in and then ensuring people move through it. But as we have moved along, it's just a maturing program.
Co-Chair Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm reading through your report rather quickly, but one of my curiosities, and it's just because I tend to look at things mathematically, is in both of these displays that are on page 14 and page 15, you talk about total workforce hours in 2013 of 666,000 hours. I'm wondering if that is some kind of a different expression than what I think it is, because 666,000 hours, if you divided it by 40 hours a week, 52 weeks, is only about the equivalent of 300 employees. So is this...
Co-chairs, Senator, yes, and I can get better definition, but these hours here are final hours on any given project for apprentices who were on it.
Right.
Now, many apprentices will come and go through the course of a job in different patterns. For example, and they sit within a matrix of journeyman to apprentice ratios that have to be considered. So if 2 days this week, or 3 days this week, you only have two pieces of equipment operating on a project, you'll have two operators working those days. If on the third day you have a third piece of equipment, you can then add an apprentice to that project.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Follow up.
I've seen that, and it looks actually obviously like there's pretty good improvement in both of these categories over that four-year period. My question had to do actually to the total workforce hours, which I think is beyond the apprenticeship hours, because it just seems like a low number for total workforce hours, unless I'm doing my math incorrectly. I mean,
Co-Chair, Senator, these are the hours we have logged, and I'll have them checked
yeah,
and
check,
maybe get you an explanation. But the staff that collects this is what they
yeah.
gave me.
Okay.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you aware of the research being done by the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs regarding the apprenticeship programs?
Representative, no, I am not.
Okay. There is a significant research effort underway that preliminary results, and I've seen some of the preliminary reports, indicate a significant problem, not in recruiting, but in apprenticeships, apprentices finishing the program. And you mentioned it, Mr. Garrett, earlier, that one of the problems has been the good old boy situation where people, where family and friends are allowed to continue to finish their the practicum for the apprenticeship, but others are not. Particular groups are noted for not doing particularly well, particular skill sets. And the Electricians Union is known for doing very well. Something on the order of the last report I saw showed 70 people going into the apprenticeship program with the Electricians Union and 60 finishing. But there were other unions and skill sets that were at 120 going in and 20 finishing. And they appear to be really related to not just the number of people being recruited, but the number of folks who were able to finish because of a number of things. And I'm curious, since you don't know that, you should be looking for that information. I'll try to get it to you.
Madam Chair, if I may, Representative Frederick, I'm aware of it, and we work closely with Portland State, who's actually done several different studies. Dr. Moore Kelly, I believe, is helping us with our disparity study and has helped kind of navigate academia on that. I would submit to you that the challenges at the front end are the challenges as we continue to move through and mature the apprentice opportunity. You get to those issues of childcare. You get to those issues of transportation. Those are really the significant barriers here. And I think as we make the investment at the front end and that pre-apprentice, we have to continue to work with our labor partners to make sure that as they continue. I think one of the findings I recall is women of color. The percentage of them not running through the tape is significantly higher than Caucasian women here. Now, that's a question that you need to dive into. And those are the types of the discussions that we're engaging Portland State with. And again, working with the labor unions to see how do we make sure that as we fill the queue, so to speak, early on, so we reach back into the high schools, into the community colleges, and even moving beyond to some of those individuals that now may be in that 24 to 20, 30-year-old age, kind of outside of the reach of college. If we plug them into the queue, how do we, again, maintain a pace so that queue continues from pre-apprentice to apprentice to journey status here? That's going to demand all of us around the table, and that includes the good folks at the commission you speak to.
Thank you very much. One quick follow-up, if you don't
mind. Follow-up, Representative Frederick.
Thank you very much. The concern, the difference between a couple of the groups, the union groups that are doing apprenticeship, appears to be that in some situations, the apprentices are told to go to a particular company. The companies are set up to receive them. In other cases, the apprentices are told to find a company to accept them. And what they discover is that they're not companies that necessarily want to accept them because they're not part of either the family that's been involved or the group that they expect to see. So I would encourage you to take a look at the report so far. It appears to be not so much talking about daycare or those other issues, but in fact, how they're treated when they get on the job. Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
Madam Chairman, I'm at that point, I'm complete, and I'll turn over to Larry.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Gesher, and if you would introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair, Co-Chair, and Representative. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to come before you and hopefully answer some questions. As you stated, my name is Larry Gesher. I'm the president of HP Civil. We're a firm that started March 1st of 2014, located in Staten, Oregon. I've been in construction for 28 years, worked up through the ranks, starting out as a laborer in the field. I worked my way through college, worked into a supervisory position, ultimately then into project management. And so I've had the experience of working in the trades and coming up through the field. We are an open shop contractor. I've always worked for an open shop contractor my whole career. So the path was a little bit different than what it is today with apprenticeship. As we're talking today, we're referring to a lot of people who are now being tracked and to why they started, why they got out. The part that we're not tracking is all the people that do come in, not through an apprenticeship program, but also leave. It's a tough industry. It's tough on family life, especially in the heavy highway sector where we work. Our people travel. You're away from home, you know, a good portion of the year. And, you know, and back to Senator Shields' request about the women not meeting the journey status, I thought about that a little bit here just today, and, you know, I can't speak from a woman working in the trades, but what I've seen is oftentimes, and you move into an area, there's an opportunity for somebody that is an apprentice to come onto a job and work. And a lot of times, obviously, the woman a lot of times is taking care of kids as well. She has responsibilities at home. Traditionally, the man is the one that, if anybody's going to travel and be the breadwinner, it's the man. So the women oftentimes will not travel. They'll choose to quit their job, stay home, wait for another job to come up, and then they could fall out of the system if there's not another work around. Different things. We do see women come in that are successful. We're seeing more women come in. As Representative Gomberg was talking to Matt here, I caught the fact that Matt's numbers are talking about workforce. The state is leading in women in the trades, not women contractors. Oftentimes we get skewed on which ones we're talking about. When Matt was talking about the numbers, he's talking about actually workforce numbers. Those are actually women out in the field working. They're not women that own construction companies. That's a different sector. And so I think that, you know, working with Matt and Tom both, I've been involved in the apprenticeship discussion since we started. It's been over 10 years ago. I give these guys great kudos for stepping back and resetting what they thought would work for apprenticeship and ultimately coming to the table with us and the unions and figuring out a system that we could all be successful in. It's in all of our best interest to grow our industry and to grow our workforce. As constructors, we've needed a skilled workforce since the beginning of man. If you think about all the pyramids that were built, all those things, guess what? There was people that were getting trained. And it wasn't through an apprenticeship program, it was on the job. We do that today. Just because you're not in an apprenticeship program doesn't mean you're not getting trained day in, day out, because that's how we're successful as contractors, is to be the most efficient we can. Because if we're not efficient, we're going to get knocked off the pedestal by our next guy behind us that has a more competitive and efficient workforce. And so stepping back and setting up the incentive disincentive program that we currently have now with the state of Oregon in the transportation side, it's enabled us to pull our subcontractors into the discussion. The contract that ODOT has with the contractors is with the general contractor only. And as Tom alluded to, it's up to the general contractor to figure out how to get the numbers that we have to achieve if we don't want to get penalized. And as a general contractor, we cannot be successful without bringing our subcontractors along. They have too many hours that they're working on the jobs as well, so we have to pull them into the same discussion that we're in. And so we've had to go through and figure out a way to contract with them, get them into the incentive disincentive program. And Kim Snook will be coming up here shortly talking about her subcontractor role and her thought on these things. And I know Kim was one of the ones I can remember having an early discussion with her. It was, a small business is tough. You have your journeyman, you have your skill set, but But now we're requiring, as a general contractor, hey, you're putting a lot of labor on the job with the work you're doing. We need you to participate, too. She'll tell you today she has apprentices. It's working. The system works. And so I'm really happy to see it go to the stage it has and be successful, because it'll continue to grow. It's in all of our best interest to grow. One of our biggest competitors for workforce is the military. As contractors, we look at the military as our number one competitor trying to get people into the field of construction. We're after the same people. It used to be that we always went after, you know, loggers. Loggers and construction are very similar. When the spotted owl hit Oregon, a lot of people rolled from logging into construction. We have a lot of people running our cranes that used to run log yarders, very similar operations. And so it's really good to have those people in our equipment, especially the older equipment that runs the same type of friction brakes and stuff that a log yarder does, because they understand how they operate. But those things are interchangeable. But there is a competition out there, and so it's who offers the best employment, the best structure as far as, you know, where do I want to go to work at? We talked about electricians, why electricians have such a good record of graduating journeymen. Typically, electricians get to work inside of buildings. They're not out in the weather as much. They're definitely a lot more local. They can stay local. You always need electricians in a given area, so a lot of electricians don't travel near as much. So you have a whole sector that does not work in the heavy highway side, but are still counted in those numbers. And so I guess if you look at the heavy highway sector only of electricians, I'm sure your numbers would probably look a lot different than what you're talking about there. And I guess with that, I think I'd like to open to questions. If there's questions, I mean, there's lots of things we could talk about here, but I think just so you understand, as industry, I forgot to identify, I'm also the president of AGC this year, the Oregon Columbia chapter, so I'm wearing multiple hats. But as an industry, we all want to grow our workforce. It's not in anyone's best interest for us not to grow a workforce. We're going to grow it with or without apprenticeship goals, because we have to have people to build our work. The one good thing about our sector of work is it can't get shipped overseas. Our work is always going to be here. So there is a career path in construction that you don't have to worry about ever getting replaced. Hopefully we're going to become more efficient. Obviously with technology, we've went a long ways. The last 10 years has been amazing. And I think the next 10 years will probably be even more so. But we're seeing things that, you know, there's new opportunities in construction with technologies, a lot more heavy skilled in computer, electronic type things that never was in construction before as a new field. Surveying, as you know, survey today, or not so much today, but in the past, has gone away. It's now going all GPS, electronic models, things like that. So there's a whole new sector taking off in our industry as well. And it's not really so much the people that are building the work as it are, is the people that are constructing the models that we're actually taking the field and building the jobs from. With that, thank you.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, any questions for Mr. Gesher? Thank you. You made reference to somebody else that maybe you had brought with you. Would they like to offer a brief testimony?
I guess
I'm sorry, on the next panel. I apologize. Yeah, I apologize. Thank you. Then we appreciate you taking the time. And now I would invite up the next panel, Mr. Williams on the telephone. Mr. Kenzie, Mr. Gesher, you get to stay there. Kimberly Snook and Director Garrett, you get to stay there.
If I can, Madam Chair, before those good folks come up from the contracting community, if I could set the stage or the rules of the game, because I think what these good folks will speak to is the environment they have to work in. And I think understanding the construct of the disadvantaged business enterprise program is important. In the transportation, this is going to seem obvious, but I have to say it. In the transportation world, it's the U.S. Department of Transportation that regulates the DBE program. It establishes the criteria for certification, which applies for DBE-eligible firms seeking contracts for federal transportation-related monies. Thought it important to define the term DBE. We use it a lot. What does it mean? A disadvantaged business enterprise includes small businesses that are at least 51% owned by women, by minorities, whether that's African American, Hispanic, Native, Asian Pacific, or subcontinent Asian firms. So that's who we're talking about when we say DBEs, and I think it's important because there are specific criteria and thresholds, percentages and financial, that inform that discussion. So that's the universe we work in. I want you to know at the Department of Transportation, ODOT has maintained a DBE program since the inception at the federal level, since the 1970s here. Now, while the Federal Highway Administration regulates the DBE program, it is truly case law that dictates the rules of the game here. The DBE programs are governed by constitutional standards that have been set by United States Supreme Court decisions back in 1989. Corson is the case they speak to, as well as a 1995 Adirond case that really frames the disciplines and the approach that a state can take as we move into the DBE discipline here and run that program here. In addition to the Supreme's ruling, we also have a host of federal appeals court rulings that reaffirm the need for a very specific, tailored, narrowly tailored is the term they use, DBE program here. You must serve some compelling government interest, and again, that's the equity opportunity of bringing people to the table. Now, significant to those rulings for the state of Oregon and ODOT was the Ninth Circuit ruling. That really changed the game for the way we conducted business. The Ninth Circuit ruled in 2005 in the Western States Paving versus the Washington Department of Transportation. What that said was that if you are to engage in a race, gender specific, if you are going to put hard goals in your contracts, you have to do the advance work to show that there was some discrimination. The vehicle to do that is a disparity study or a well-tailored discipline here. So when the Ninth Circuit ruled, the Department of Transportation was actually threatened with a lawsuit, that if you don't stop this, we're going to sue you. So we had to eliminate that race, gender conscious element of our program here, because we were surgically striking with percentages within our contracts for the various groups that I spoke to earlier. We can no longer set specific goals without something like a disparity study. So following that suspension and that ruling, we engage just such a discipline here.
Mr. Garrett, yeah. If I could interrupt you. When you contract for the disparity study, who did you contract with?
So we are in our third iteration. Back in 2007 was the first, and that was with a firm out of Atlanta called MGT. It is a firm that has conducted many disparity studies across the nation, and actually their work had been case tested. They were never defeated in court, which means the legal construct in which they put together their disparity studies were upheld by the court. So using them, again, a competitive process, we said come all, we need the best. MGT secured the first two. A little bit later, and I may be redundant, and I apologize, but it's just built into the pace of the presentation. We are at the beginning of the third disparity study update, or the second disparity study. So in 2007, we engaged the first. That set a foundation. In 2011, we updated it, and they were beginning. We're right at the first early stages here in 2015 for a study that will engage to update those activities here. I'll jump ahead very quickly here, because there are some findings that inform the landscape in which the contracting community and my agency need to play. In that 2007 study, we did indeed find, and this is a legal term, substantial underutilization in the contracting world of African-American DBE-owned firms as well as Asian-Pacific DBE firms here. We secured a waiver from the U.S. Department of Transportation Secretary where we could come back now and re-engage those hard targets just for those specific groups that had experienced that underutilization. So we did just that. Again, African-American DBE firms and subcontinent Asian firms here. So that's That's the engagement we have played under to date. We're permitted to do that. I will come back at the end and tell you how we're doing. What are the reports coming back that we have in hand right now? But what will, we hope, this 2015 disparity study show as we move? That will culminate in 2016. But I thought I'd give you at least the regulatory as well as the legal environment that the DBE program exists in, and how that will play itself out with the contracting community as they try to navigate these waters doing business with the Department of Transportation.
Thank you, Mr. Garrett. Colleagues, any questions for Director Garrett? All right, thank you. If the panel would come up, Mr. Williams by telephone, Mr. Kenzie, Mr. Gesher, Ms. Snook, and Mr. Garrett, you'll come back at the end. Good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you for taking your time to join us today. Would it be acceptable to you all if we started with Mr. Williams on the telephone? Mr.
Yes.
Williams, may we engage you, please? You have a panel of legislators here and invited testimony at the witness table, and so you're on, please.
Okay. Well, Senator Duncan, I appreciate the opportunity to be able to call in on this. I'm sorry I couldn't be there today. My name is Scott Williams. I'm president of Hamilton Construction. I've been working in this industry right now going on 41 years. Our firm has been in business 76 years, starting in 1939. Currently, we have a little over 200 employees, and that'll expand probably to 250 during the hard construction season during the summers. We're primarily a heavy highway contractor specializing in bridge construction, doing most of our work for DOTs and for many of the railroads around the Northwest. We are currently working on DOT projects in four states, including Oregon. Our main office is in Coburg, Oregon, but we have permanent division offices in Alaska and Colorado as well. I was asked to provide some numbers to give context of what we do and what we've done with the DBE program over the last 5 years. And so what I've got is a snapshot of some statistics that we have put together from June of 09 through June of 14, which is where we have the most current records we have had up to date. And during that time period, we had contracted with ODOT for approximately $310 million worth of work in those 5 years. That's about 60% of our volume. That varies year to year and is consistently been going down over the last few years. This year we'll do probably about 33% of our work with ODOT. During that same time period, we have subcontracted to 193 subcontractors. Some of those may be the same subcontractors because we have multiple projects and you could have the same subs on multiple projects. In addition, of those 193 subs, 47 of those were DBE subcontracts. Total that we subcontracted out of the $310 million that we performed was $132 million worth of subcontracts were issued, approximately 42%.
Mr. Williams? Mr. Williams. Okay. I think while we ask the professional staff to see if we can get Mr. Williams connected back up again, we'll proceed with the panel that we have. And I'm happy to have you proceed in any order that you would like.
Okay. I'm Kerry Kinsey. I'm the president of K&E Excavating, and we're here right out of Salem, Oregon. I started a lot like Larry, right out of high school as a laborer, worked in an operator, and then we had the opportunity to start our own business. My partner and I started in April of
'98.
Hi, Scott. I'm sorry we dropped your call somehow.
Yeah, somehow I just dropped it. So anyway, I'm not sure where it dropped in what I was talking about. So yeah.
Mr.
Like I was talking about, we have subcontracted with 193 subs. Was that part?
Yes. That's where you left off.
Okay. And then of those, 47 were DBE, so 24% of the subcontracts that we had were with the DBE community. Like I say, of $310 million, $132 million were subcontracted. Of that, $26.2 million went to DBE subcontractors, or about 20% of the volume of the subcontracts. And that's, we feel, is fairly consistent with the fact that many of the DBEs are smaller firms, and thus they have smaller subcontracts. So although we have more, a higher percentage with the DBE firms, the volume isn't quite as high on the average. So those are some numbers that some background of what Hamilton has done with the DBE firms and subcontracted out in the last 5 years on DOT projects. In addition, I wanted to comment a little bit about the disparity study in general, and then also what we've seen in the DBE community and issues that we have had working within the program. I think we've seen a lot of growth in many firms, you know, and capacity and the ability to take on work and the ability to expand. We've had some firms graduate out of the program, although not as many as I think everybody would have hoped for. But there's a lot of issues that have caused problems and why the program hasn't done better. And for example, I would throw out what's called CUF, commercial useful function. Our ability to help DBEs day-to-day work on the job site is somewhat limited in comparison to a non-DBE firm. And that has to do with helping them with equipment, helping them with labor, with issues that happen day-to-day if they break down, providing them like with a forklift or providing them with a crane. If that's not written into the subcontract, we walk a very fine line on being found guilty of a violation of commercial useful function. That's just the way the rules are written by the federal government. We have all got to play by them, but it does restrict us sometimes in helping these firms expand and become better contractors. The other thing that restricts some ability is the NEES codes. They can't expand outside of the work they normally do when they are certified as the DBE. We can't use them to do a function that they haven't been certified for, even though they may want to expand. If they can't prove that they've got the ability, it somewhat restricts their ability to expand and do work that they could very well be able to complete, but we're not allowed to use them as a DBE to do that work. We've talked a little bit on the apprenticeship side about the willingness of the apprentices or the ability to travel. We find the same thing in DBE firms and in small firms altogether, not just DBEs. But for example, we have a job in Newburgh right now, building part of the Newburgh Dundee bypass. And they'd had a DBE goal on it. We had firms out of Portland that weren't willing to do work in Newburgh because that was too far to travel. And, you know, so if you can't, you're not willing to travel 35 miles, it does restrict what we're able to do when we have a job in Medford or a job in Klamath Falls and being able to meet goals. The other thing I'd like to say is because of how our past disparity studies, what they've shown, and that underutilization of the African American and subcontinent Asians, many of the other DBEs that were certified, the other ethnic minorities or women-owned businesses, have dropped out of the program because they feel their participation doesn't count. And there's a lot of paperwork involved in staying in the DBE program, and they've just said, why should I do this if I don't count towards the goal anymore? And I think it's become increasingly difficult for us, therefore, to meet the some of the goals, not the hard goals, but some of the other goals that are set out there. And then statewide, we'd like to do 13%. I think it's 13% of DVEs. It's become increasingly difficult because those firms are no longer certified. So and the other thing is I've sat in the two meetings so far that we've had with the new firm doing the disparity, going to be doing the disparity study, and I found them to be very open, very willing to listen to everybody. I think it's a step in the right direction that the DOT and has done a great job of selecting a firm that's really going to look into this and also take a look at the ability to perform, not just the willingness to perform. I think that's important for success of any firm, is you got to have some ability to perform. So in general, that's my comments, and I would open to questions of me, or if we want to wait to the end, I'll stay on the phone and listen to questions then.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. We'll take a question for you now. Senator Shields, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment, Mr. Williams, that from what I had heard, it's been a while since, you know, I've tracked this because I'm just now back onto Ways and Means, but I remember hearing how impressed my community was with the job that Hamilton had done since 2008 moving forward. So it seems like you're on the right track, and I just wanted to give you some compliments for that.
Well, I appreciate that comment.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Williams? Then thank you, sir, for allowing us to reconnect with Mr. Williams.
Sure.
So, Mr. Kinsey, please.
All right. So I'll start over. So I'm Kerry Kinsey, president of K&E Excavating, and we're right here in Salem. So like I said, I started right from the bottom and worked our way up, and then my partner and I started in April of 98, so it's almost 17 years ago. We started out with just two of us, and right now we have like 205 employees. So we do the mainly larger heavy highway civil work, which includes all the site work, utilities, trucking, grinding, and small concrete work. We also do some residential and commercial site work. In 2014, we had approximately $45 million contracted with ODOT, which was about 55% of our total volume for last year. Now, I know that sounds like a lot of money, but 45 minutes, that's the volume, that's not profit. And I'm not speaking for anybody else, but when we're bidding with margins of 2 to 5%, it doesn't take much to mess up that percentage and you're in the hole. So I've actually made jokes at our Christmas parties that we're trying to be a profit group and not a nonprofit. So I'm here because I was asked to give my perspective as a contractor for ODOT on a DBU program. I look at the DBU program as another requirement to do ODOT work. So it's really nothing different for me than anything else that ODOT requires. We try to do our best to make it work, and we do make it work to complete the requirements of the job. When we are the successful low bidder in a project, ODOT expects us to deliver a quality project on time and on budget. And the only way we can do that is our whole team, that includes subcontractors and DB subcontractors, we have to work closely together. For us to be successful, everybody has to be successful. But we as a prime do pretty much, we take all the risk on the job, and we have to be accountable for all of our subs. So we take who we subcontract with seriously. ODOT looks to us to make it all work with a team that we put together on bid day. So here are a few things we have done that we try to do to help our DBs be successful. We have had in the past a DB subcontractor, a trucking company, and he showed up on a job with three trucks. Two of them had never been in a dump truck before in their life. They did get their license, but they didn't know how it worked, how it operated or anything. So we literally had to take two of our drivers out of the field, put them in the passenger seat, and go with them. I believe it was half a day to help them to understand. Otherwise, it was too dangerous for them and for our people on our site. We also have two projects going right now that we're using two different DB subcontractors for trucking. And one job, they showed up about half of their people, about half the trucks that we needed. The other one, they showed up for 1 day, which, you know, and we were promised four trucks, so it makes it difficult to make our goal. We will make the goal, and it will come through, but at this point, I'm not sure exactly how. So 2015 will be important for those. I have been asked to help find trucks for these people to buy, help them find drivers. And it's obviously, like Scott said, it's a fine line. We got to be careful. And even with mechanics, we've had trucks broke down on site. Our mechanics are there. And sometimes they don't have the means or methods to get a mechanic out. So we take care of them. We take care of little stuff, help them get back on the road and get going instead of letting them sit there for 3 or 4 hours, because that's, to me, that's part of working together. We've also had to, we try to help them all fill out their paperwork so it's correct. A lot of times they want our project manager, they'd like them to fill out all the paperwork and they want to sign it. And sometimes we go through it with them, like preventing wage reports, their Form 3A, just to make sure it's all correct. In the past, we've actually, I've had to pay people on a particular project. They had an agreement to pay their people on the site, and it was a Port of Portland job, to pay them a certain wage, which was not legal, and it was under the preventing wage rate. So when we got the letter from Bully and are notified to get the job closed out and done, we got the list and we paid the people that way it could get closed out of Bully, and then we dealt with a DV subcontractor. And really, you know, he had no means or methods, and we haven't gotten reimbursed to this date. But that's part of the risk we deal with on a daily basis. We also do a lot of two-party checks, which helps to make sure their suppliers get paid. And everybody that they have, like their, it's mainly their suppliers. So that's a few things that we try to do.
With that little break, I'm going to take a question from Representative Whitsitt.
Yes.
I was just wondering, and I don't think you know this, Mr. Garrett may, somebody may know this, how many projects that ODOT has undertaken have involved cost overruns, and of those cost overruns, how many were related to inadequately prepared subcontractors like you're talking about?
I'm going to suggest we let Mr. Garrett ponder that question
okay.
and when he
Great.
Comes up here to close. And so if you would continue your testimony,
okay.
sir.
So I believe a couple of the biggest challenges are availability and price. Part of the issues we've had with DBs not showing up is they are spread too thin. They are overcommitted on jobs, and they really don't have the resources to get what's needed to fulfill their commitments and contracts, even though their prices are on the average 10 to 30% higher than non-DBEs. So a few stats that I have for our company is we use approximately 50 different subcontractors. Approximately 7 to 10 of the subs are DB firms, or 10 to 14%. 40% of our total ODOT volume goes to subs. And out of this, we have approximately 7, 8% of this, 40% goes to DB firms. So I've got four jobs listed we're currently working on. The first one, ODOT, for Woodburn Interchange. We use Nate Hartley Oil for $950,000. Black Diamond Asphalt for $1.6. Peter Actar for $100,000. A to Z Flagging for $338,000, for a total of right at $2 million, or 6% of the total contract. US 101 in Lincoln City, Peter Actar for $265,000, All About Flagging for $245,000, for a total of $510,000, or 5.05% of the total contract. Mount Hood, Highway 26, which is a government camp, that widening we're working on, is Double RS for $300,000, Peter Actar for $420,000, for a total of $720,000, or 3.71% of the total contract. Job we're going to be starting, we haven't got it awarded yet, but it's I-5 Onloff Elkhead. Is Double RS is $1.3 million. Peter Actar for $405,000, for a total of $1.185 million, or 4.02% of total contract. So that is pretty much mine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Colleagues, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate you coming and and telling us the unvarnished truth. I mean, I think what the reason we're having this hearing, the reason why hopefully we'll have one in another year, is to, we want to know the real situation, and then we want you to put more points on the scoreboard. So so thanks for coming and taking time away from your busy day to tell us what's going on in the field. I think I know that there are, you know, kind of the small DB contractors that are challenging, but then, of course, you know, I can think of two or three trucking and excavation outfits that have 15 or 16 trucks and, you know, a bookkeeper and two or three staff in the office. Mm-hmm. I think part of what we also want to do is just make sure that everybody is connecting to one another on this topic, too.
Correct.
So thanks for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Gesher?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Once again, Larry Gesher with HP Civil. I didn't state earlier, my business is an emerging small business, so we are certified as a small business in the state of Oregon. I guess I'll give a little bit of a different perspective coming from, I worked for a company called Slayton Construction out of Staten for 9 years prior to going out on my own. And so I've had the opportunity to work on some really big jobs throughout the state of Oregon, to where the DBE piece is a huge piece of the job. I worked on the Lant River Bridge with Scott Williams' firm, and also on the Selwood Bridge, where I was project manager there for the prior three years prior to starting my own business. So working in Multnomah County with a very high target of 20% DBE goal was a real challenge. It came down to working on a Multnomah County project. It's a CMGC contract. And CMGC opens a lot of things up for a contractor as how we can do business, because we haven't bid the job yet. When we're going through the contracting phase, we're not through design. And so when we know ahead of time what our targets are going to be, who our demographic is in the area, we can tailor not only the design but how we bid out the packages. And so very early on in the process, I started laying out the packages to achieve 20%. And that's the only way you could get to that type of goal. We also set up things as mentorships. So I picked through the process, I ended up with three firms that I mentored on Selwood Bridge specifically. And mentorship, I guess, to me, it's a way to take an owner and move them to the next level. It's not a way to take somebody and make them a contractor. What I found is oftentimes I came across people that were in, that owned a business that did not know how to build the work in the field. And as a contractor, I cannot imagine being a business and not being able to go out and put the work in place myself if I needed to. You, for one thing, you have to have the respect of the people that work for you. And not just that, but you have to know when they're actually giving you an honest day's work and when they're not. And so the typical, I guess, as I would say, how a contractor is hatched, much like Kerry said, you start out at the bottom. You start as a laborer. You work your way through up through the crafts. You become a superintendent. You move into management. You spend enough time in management to where you finally feel comfortable that you understand the majority of what you're going to get into as a business owner, and then you take the leap into being a business owner. And that's how you're successful in my eyes. And going through many businesses that are DBEs, that's not necessarily the path they've taken. It's, there's an opportunity there to be a contractor, so you become a contractor. And so you try to learn on the fly, and it's hard. Up there, we had several contractors that we were making their payments to them weekly so they can make payroll. And these are people that have been around for 10-plus years in business. And so, as Scott mentioned earlier, it's a tough line to walk and where we can help, what we can't do. But we have to do a certain amount of things for them to be successful. When I ran into this, obviously we knew it was an issue before Bully came to us and said this individual hadn't been paying his employees, because we kept really close contact with all of our staff on the job to make sure, because that's our biggest risk as a contractor. Kerry mentioned writing joint checks. The reason we're writing joint checks as a prime contractor, because ultimately we're responsible for everyone's bills on our projects, not just our own. If we pay a subcontractor for their work that they're completed, if they don't pay their bills, it comes back to us and we get to pay again. So we watch very closely for the tea leaves out there to find out if we hear things coming out of the employees that work for the company or any of their vendors we watch very closely to make sure we don't see flags that there's issues. And when there are flags, then we start addressing them through joint checks, having meetings with them. The individual up there that I worked very closely with for a two-year period before I left, he's obviously working with Bully. Bully has not debarred him from bidding, even though he was not paying his employees the full fringe. He was pocketing it. We caught it. We were able to keep him, go backwards, and we got every employee that he had worked on the job site whole. So all their retirement is current, and I think he learned a lot going through the process. But it's a challenge. It's a challenge on our staff to do it. And not just that, but there's other firms out there that may not be a DBE that could do a better job. But we're fulfilling a goal and a need, and we understand that. And so keeping those things and working with the people is what we do to be successful. Carrie said it, we have to have a complete team in order to be successful. That complete team is every person on that job. And you know, the best thing we can do as an industry is grow more contractors. More contractors means our lives working as a general contractor is easier. We have better coverage for people bidding the projects because there's more competition. And so it's in our best interest as well as anybody's to grow this industry of small businesses. With that, I'm going to hush up.
Thank you very much. Senator Shields.
Thank you. I guess this would be to Larry. A couple things that I heard about talking to some pretty decent-sized DBE contractors. One is on the issue of whether or not they're willing to travel. One was kind of scratching their head and kicking the ground saying, you know, look, in Region 1, there was a job in Portland that had a 1% hard goal, but then the one in, you know, Roseburg had a 6% hard goal. And I was wondering if you ever saw that in any of the bids that came out from ODOT where in the Portland area, the number was low for minority contracting, but then higher in other places. And
Matt's probably could be better respond to that, but I'll say this. I know in the Portland market working up there, it's tough because you're competing with City of Portland, you're competing with TriMet, who all have their own individual programs, and DBEs are going to go to where it's the most lucrative. What's the easiest path to make the money? And so ODOT's very stringent. They have very strict guidelines because their funding is coming through Federal Highway. And so they follow guidelines that they cannot waver from, otherwise they lose funding. And there's a difference when the City of Portland doesn't have that same criteria in how they're able to do it, because I've worked for the City of Portland. I've worked on the other side from ODOT jobs, and I see the difference. So comparing the two is somewhat comparing apples and oranges, but seeing the lower goal, I mean, I can't say why he did that, but I can tell from a contractor standpoint, we're fighting for a limited amount of resources in an area, and so that could be part of it.
Thank you. I would ask Director Garrett to flag that question and address it as well. Sure. Senator Shields, follow-up.
By the way, I've been hearing very good things about you and your work at Sladen in the past with the minority contracting community. Another thing that, and feel free anybody could comment on it, is that some minority contractors feel like they're put into the proposal for, you know, $800,000. The general gets the bid, and then rather than actually getting $800,000 worth of work, it gets scaled back to $200,000, and the person really is sitting there without much recourse saying, you know, I was anticipating all of this, the $800,000 worth of work, and now I'm only getting two. And I was wondering if you all had seen that happen amongst any of your colleagues, or if that's something that's on your radar screen.
I guess I've heard a little bit from the industry on that in the past, and part of it has to do with most of the heavy highway contracts are unit price based. And so everything that you get paid is based on units that you work you put in place. And so if the units are off at all in from the design side to what we actually build in the field, we only get paid for what we put in place. So our contract values go all over the place as far as values, and it's based on what we actually build. So obviously the designers do their best job of trying to catch all the quantities. We check them when we're bidding. But until you're in the field and you actually start where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, and getting the quantities for earthwork and things lined out closer, their contracts can go down as a result of just based on the units weren't there to put in place. You mentioned proposals. So that kind of flags a different side when you say proposals to me, because proposals typically in our line of work is more alternative contracting. Typically, if it's a bid, you know, we call it a bid, but I'm not sure if you were referring to alternative or just, okay. So just a hard bid project, I mean, my explanation may be just a fact of the units were off. I can't tell you what else could be there, but It also could be a lot of times when we get into things, too, I've done in the past where once you get in, you start checking the background of people as far as financial abilities and things they can do, we'll set up a rolling contract just for the fact of we don't want to bury them. And so I did this a lot at Selwood, too, is you'd piecemeal their contracts saying, okay, here's a piece of work, let's go through, work this, make sure we can work it all through, and you award the process as you go through to make sure that they're successful. Because we last thing we want to do is to overpower somebody with the amount of work you give them. And it's a balancing act. I've seen a lot up there trying to balance the different, you know, TriMet contracts, City of Portland contracts, and now a new ODOT contract in town. And so we actually started a forum in Portland when I was up there of all the large contractors working in the whole metropolitan area, because we realize we're all fighting and using the same resource. And so we're struggling with each other because I need them here, you need them there. And so we start using this round table as a way to try to help the minorities. If somebody saw a flag on their job, it's sooner or later that flag was going to show up in the other jobs. And so we started talking and started trying to curtail those red flags as soon as we saw it. Whoever job it was, they would meet with the person and try to help to solve it so it didn't roll into all the other contracts. Because we saw it multiple times where somebody would have an issue in one job, and sooner or later it affected all their projects, which hit all of us. It was working well. There was a lot to it. It was just a way for us to try to not have problems fester into something that ultimately took a contractor down.
Thank you very much. I want to make time for Ms. Snook, but I'd also like to ask a rhetorical question, and I'm not asking any of you to respond. I would be very curious to know about Boley not enforcing against someone who was failing to pay their workers. And I would like to make sure that there is uniform treatment by Boley of all classes of alleged miscreants. If they're not performing, I would have an expectation that there be a uniform application of Boley sanctions. And you don't have to respond to that.
Well, I can just tell you they are. It's just taking longer.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Snook, please, your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Kim Snook. My business name is 4S Sign, and I'm located in Albany, Oregon. I do work all throughout the state of Oregon. Been in business, well, the business has been there since 1958. I've had control of it for the last 20 years. We do signs, temporary signs, permanent signs for the heavy highway contractors. I've worked with both these gentlemen on multiple occasions, as well as Scott and most of the other contractors, prime contractors in the state of Oregon. I've worked as a prime contractor occasionally if the job is appropriate. One of the projects we worked on was re-signing Interstate 5 from Brant's Pass for 153 miles north. That was a big project. It's a lot of fun. Larry called me yesterday, thank you very much, and said, was I available to be here and talk with you today, which I'm very happy to do. However, I did not have time to prepare a lot of information for you. I'm happy to answer any questions. Let me go backwards a little bit. After working in the highway signing business for about 5 or 6 years, and this is back in the early 90s, I decided it would be beneficial to become a DBE, and I did so, and worked as a DBE diligently for the next 20 years. Last year, I took myself out of the program for a variety of reasons. I'll let you start asking me those reasons, because I don't want to sound like I'm complaining about things. So anyone who wants to ask me, feel free.
nice team. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering why you dropped out of the program.
What an interesting question. When ODOT started its disparity programs, with all the good intentions, started narrowing down the field of opportunity, I saw a lot of things going on that I had a hard time dealing with, including, Carrie mentioned, I believe, some of the hard goal companies were charging way more than what the rest of us were bidding at. Took a level playing field and completely turned it upside down. And we worked, several of my colleagues and I worked for years to try and right that. It seemed to only get worse. There was no benefit to my company. Now I've got 15 to 20 at any given time employees, which to me translates to 15 to 20 families that I need to take care of. I need to focus on that, not what's not working for me somewhere else. Hope that answers.
Got a follow-up?
Follow-up. Representative Buckley.
Thank you very much. It does answer when you talk about upending the level playing field, because you've been in the business for a while. Can you give me a kind of concrete example of like a specific job or something that you could point to that says we were bidding here and something else came in at a different level and you just found it to be unfair and how you tried to address that?
Several years ago, there was a project down in the Mid-Valley, probably about 5 miles from my office. And that was when the goal went to African-American and Asian. It was before its current goal of subcontinent Asian.
Right.
The contractor that was awarded the project, the subcontractor that was awarded the project, was bidding 30% higher than where I was. But because they met the hard goal, the prime had no option but to take that contract. Those kinds of issues.
Thank you.
Colleagues, that certainly raises an interesting question for all of us that are struggling to find adequate dollars to put on the roads right now to improve a crumbling system. Any other questions for any of the panel? Representative Gomber.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank all of these contractors for coming forward with their candor and this background information, both the ones that are at the desk and the ones on the phone. But, Mr. Kunze, I particularly wanted to say that the Lincoln City is at the middle of my district, as well as being my hometown. I have heard nothing but positive feedback about the work that you and your crews are doing, your compassion and your communication with the neighbors and the businesses along where that work's being done. So I wanted to thank you for that. As you well know, it's a two-year project. You're doing good work there. We can't wait for you to be gone.
Thank you very much. That's good to hear.
Well, on that note, I think I'm going to ask Mr. Garrett to come back up. Thank you all for coming, taking time away as your season is starting, and we appreciate your testimony very, very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Williams, you're welcome to stay for Mr. Garrett's wrap-up or to leave us, your choice.
I'll stay on and hear what Matt has to say.
Thank you. Welcome back, Director Garrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. So I have three issues I'll follow up. I'll start with Representative Whitsitt's question, Senator Shields, and then Mr. Williams actually said something I want to speak to as well in his remarks. So I can say with confidence to Madam Chair, to Representative Whitsitt's question, none. We do not pay for the challenges a sub may have. That's the responsibility of the prime. What the department pays for is work completed. And so that's the relationship we have. So as the example was given out, that fell to the responsibility of the prime contractor to cover whatever cost or exposures that may have played itself out because that sub could not perform its function. We don't pay for that. We pay for the work. Now, we do have change orders in terms of contract, but that's because the work product changes. We're doing something differently than we originally had engaged. So I'm confident in saying none. To Senator Shield, if I may, the question about why is there a distinction between a Portland project, a Roseburg project, and why are the percentages different? I think there are several reasons. And not knowing the projects, I'm going to speak in generalities here. But we look at the type of work activity. I think early on in Mr. Lauer's presentation, the complexities and the nuances associated with bridge work, there are many types of activities that create opportunity, whereas a pavement project, a basic pavement project, you don't have all those type of activities, so there's less opportunity, so the capacity is not there to engage it. So when we look at projects, we're really looking at the type of work, the activities expertise associated with that work, the volume of work as well, and then the capacity that exists in the DBE world to actually address it. You know, there may be a big bridge work that is taking a capacity, significant investment in other projects that thins the herd, so to speak, here. So there are many variables in the equation that may affect why a project in Portland may have a 1% DBE goal or requirement versus something out and down in Southern Oregon that may be different. Again, we'd have to look specifically at those projects. I'm happy to do that if you wish, but that's a general statement to that. If I may, Mr. Williams, who is a very good business partner, they put good product on the ground, and you drive over it each and every day, I can assure you there. But he said something that I think I need to bring some clarity. Mr. Williams indicated that there were some DBE firms that aren't the African American or the subcontinent Asians that felt, we no longer count, we don't play. That's something we had to fight. I think, to be very honest, we had to fight it not only in the DBE world, but also in the prime contractor world, because I think there was some prime contractors that said, hey, we're only going to play with the ones we get credit for. The bottom line is, that's a specious argument here. We have an overall goal. And again, I'll just give you the most current information that we are now working with the Federal Highway Administration. So in 2015-2016, we have a an overall goal of 10.6%. So that's looking at all the availability, all the projects and the activities. We do the math, and there are probably other variables that I'm missing. But when all is said and done, 10.6 of the work percentage of the work needs to go to DBEs. Now, that is broken out into two categories. One, specific to race conscious, and we spoke about that, the African-American-owned DBE firms, as well as the subcontinent Asian. Of that 10%, those hard targets to those specific groups where we have identified significant or substantial underutilization is only 2.7%. So there's 7.9% of what we would term race neutral activities that would go and make available to all DBEs, no matter what color or composition or complexion. So that's a responsibility of all of us sitting around the table to ensure we have an overarching goal we need to meet, and we strive for that. Then we have some specifics we have to target, because the disparity study has indicated that there is an unlevel playing ground, that there has been underutilization of these classes, the African Americans and the subcontinent Asians. And so we're trying to right that playing ground to some extent. I'm going to talk about that because Ms. Snook broached an issue that it is a fluid playing ground here, and it's kind of a teeter-totter type thing that is always moving and we have to address. I think, Madam Chair, very quickly, as I said, we have engaged this process to understand the environment we work in. Are people disadvantaged? Is there an underutilization or an uneven playing ground? Because I think we have a responsibility. I think there is a compelling interest to assure there's equal opportunities for people to compete. And our job is to ensure that the barriers that would deny them are removed. But we got to bring those people, all people, to the table here. So the question is, we have these specific targets. So how are we doing? So if you ask yourself, specific to those DBAs, how are we faring on the projects since we put that into place? I'm happy to say that the reports I have today, and they will be informed by this disparity study that we're kicking off, but that's a year out from now. The reports that I show that have today show that African American and subcontinent Asian American owned DBAs, again, the two groups eligible for those specific goals, have increased their participation over the last few years. And this is particularly noticeable in the DBE subcontractor participation environment here. This shows that African American DBE's participation has nearly doubled. So in 2011, we were at 2.58%. We have increased that in 2014 to just a little over 5%, 5.01%. So, again, the tool, the disparity study to move the dial specific to African Americans, it is doing that. Likewise, the subcontinent Asian American DBE-owned firms have increased from zero, none in 2011, to just a little over 3% in 2014. Now, to Ms. Snook's statement here, some DBE groups are that are not covered by that waiver that permits us to strike at that hard target for African American and Asian, subcontinent Asians, are seeing a decline that is playing itself out in the Hispanic community as well as the women-owned DBEs. So again, the playing ground is shifting. There are probably a variety of reasons to do that. I will tell you, that's not lost on me. And we are currently engaged with the Federal Highway Administration, not only here in the state of Oregon, but back in Washington, D.C., to say we have an exposure. In our effort to try to level the playing ground, there is another tilt. What options do we have available to us to right now deal with modifying that, to realign, to try to bring back into balance as best we can? I think it's a race that probably doesn't have a finish line, to be very honest with you. We'll continue to monitor these things. But again, you have a Department of Transportation that has been willing to say, we're going to go out and ask the questions. If indeed there is discrimination, let's move from the rhetoric to the real, and that's what a disparity study is doing. And as was mentioned before, we now stand at the forefront of engaging a new company, Keen Independent Research, to take on the next update of the disparity study. Everything that we hear, they're going to do business a little bit differently than MGT. And that's not to say MGT didn't do a good job. They laid foundational work. But we now have an approach from a research firm that showed itself head and shoulders above the folks that competed for it, ensuring that we'll be comprehensive, ensuring that we'll have all voices to inform this, and they've actually been riding circuit. They were in Bend earlier this week, down in Roseburg, they'll be in Salem, and they'll be up in Portland to ensure that all voices inform the discussion before we truly roll it out here. Bottom line is, a disparity study is truly a legal construct here. But we have to make sure we listen to all people who are touched by it. Madam Chair, as this moves forward, I promise you, as the findings demonstrate themselves, we'll be happy to come back and speak before your committee on those findings.
Thank you, Mr. Garrett, for your concluding comments. We're out of time, colleagues, and so unless there are any last questions, seeing none, we're adjourned.
Yes.
Seeing none, we're adjourned.
Yes.
Questions?